This is OSLCC Chapter 25, Tracing Our Roots, celebrating 25 years of cultural centers. Broncos, some near, some far, but no matter where you are, we're speaking to you and we hope you're listening. And you never know, we might even be engaging with you real soon.
Okay, so welcome to our podcast. This is a part of the 25th anniversary of the Cultural Centers and part of the Pride Center podcast, Open Closet. And most importantly, thank you for taking the time to help us create this gift for future generations, for the Pride Center and the Cultural Centers in general. So we can now introduce ourselves. So for listeners, I'm Bree Serrano. I use he, him, and they, them pronouns. I'm the current coordinator of the Pride Center, and I'm excited to be here with y'all. Rory, would you like to introduce yourself?
Yes, thank you. First of all, thank you for the opportunity to be here. It's really, really exciting. So first of all, my name is Roy. I am a Cal Poly student, sixth year, psychology major with the animal science minor, and I'm in SJL for the Pride Center.
Thanks. And we have a special guest with us today, who is the founder of the Pride Center, Johnny Owens, who was our first full-time director and coordinator. So Johnny, would you like to introduce yourself?
Sure. I'm Johnny Owens, and I'm now retired, but I spent about 25 years at Cal Poly Pomona. And yes, I found myself as the first coordinator of the Pride Center. And that was an interesting happenstance. And and I loved it. And so it was a great opportunity for me. And I had many wonderful years there. And I'm also an alum of Cal Poly Pomona.
Okay,
behavioral
great.
Sciences with minors in women's studies and criminal justice and corrections.
Oh, wow. That's awesome. And you know, we'll be adding in some follow-up questions potentially or comments as we go on with the recording. And thank you so much for being here today. It's super exciting to have this knowledge shared. So to get us started, if you don't mind sharing with us about how did the Pride Center come to be and what was that experience like for you?
Okay. Actually, people always give me credit and I give it back to the students because the students were the ones that did the work. They laid the groundwork and I just was in the right place at the right time, kind of. So I actually was an employee in the police department on campus. I came to campus and my first job there was a dispatcher in the police department. So when I got promotions and different things. So when the Pride Center came to be, I believe I was the special assistant to the chief of police. I did a lot of education and crime prevention, things like that, liaison for the department with the community. And so I also was the co-chair of the faculty and staff, the gay and lesbian faculty staff. And then the students had no advisor. So they had come to me and asked me to be their advisor. It was called GALA at that time, Gay and Lesbian Alliance.
Oh, so yes.
That was my name, that on paper for them. There wasn't a lot of action. Actually, the club was fairly quiet, but it was chartered and they needed an advisor. So I was that. So there was a lot of student activism on campus. And I remember, here I'm in the police department, you know, but Metcha and a lot of the students, they took over building one, which used to be the administration building, had a sit-in, and they wanted space. They had a list of demands. And I really wasn't in the middle of that. So I can only speak to my knowledge, but eventually cultural centers were born, and they decided that there would be three cultural centers, the African American Cultural Center, the Asian Pacific Islander Center, and the Cesare Chavez Center. Mm-hmm. And then the gay and lesbian students were very upset because they said, you know, we need this. We need this, you know, a great deal. And so kind of as an afterthought, we were given this little tiny closet. I think it's adjacent to the African American Student Center. It's that little tiny room.
Oh, yeah.
So we were actually given
that. Wow, that's so small.
Another, Yeah, the other centers all had halftime. They were hired halftime coordinators, and they had student assistant budgets, and they had new furniture and all this. We were given this little tiny room and no budget, and I was a volunteer from my position in the police department. So I was truly a volunteer, and I eventually was able to get some student assistant money. And so I hired student assistants who were actually would sit in the center a few hours a day, and they came up with the logo. They would greet people, and people gave us office items, office supplies. Yeah. Actually, parking, you'll be glad to know if you've ever paid a parking ticket. My boss was the chief of police, and I said, Kim, how are we supposed to do this? I don't have anything. How am I supposed to, you know, have an office? And she said, Johnny, go into the parking cupboards there. And I don't think this is a big secret or anything. And she goes, take what you need. You know, so I'm getting a stapler and paper and whatever. And people were really great on campus. They'd call me up because they knew that the Pride Center didn't have resources. So they'd call me up and say, hey, the president's office. Somebody, I had a friend in the president's office. She said, hey, we're getting a brand new copier. I've got this really nice copier. Do you want it? And I'm like, yeah, I want it. So people would give us stuff. And we eventually came up to the same, you know, budgeting and everything as the other cultural centers. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of how it started. And I was halftime. Eventually, I mean, I was volunteer. Eventually, it was taking so much of my time that my boss talked to the VP of Student Affairs, and they made my position. I had the weirdest position in the world. I was the special assistant to the chief of police. Halftime was crime prevention and, you know, community relations, and this, and then half of it was running the Pride Center. And that was my, it was probably the weirdest job that HR ever wrote up, but that was my official job for a while until it became a full-time position.
How long did it take for you to become full-time in that role?
I'm trying to think. Probably, you know, I can't remember exactly, but probably less than a year. The year Matthew Shepard was murdered, because I really loved my job. I wrote, I was the major writer on the grant that started the Violence Against Women Office and things. So I did really meaningful things that I loved in the police department. And I got to do the clothesline project, a lot of domestic violence awareness, things like that. So I loved it. And so half and half was okay. At one point, the VP asked me to be full-time, and I really didn't know what to do because I had this big grant, and I wanted to actually be the person who fulfilled that grant and different things like that. So I have really had a struggle, but he really wanted me to do it. I think he had a trust in me. So I said yes. And then that was in October. And I remember because I was up in my office in October, and I was just there a short time, and Matthew Shepard was murdered, and students were running in my office crying and upset. And I thought, this, you know, I need to be here. I made the right decision. I need to be here. And so that was the proper decision for me. So I think I probably started in that position right before school started or something, or in the summer, you know, something like that in that year. So I can't remember exactly how long it was.
Yeah. Thanks for sharing that.
I'm actually kind of surprised that the location to begin with, that was such a small space.
You know, yeah.
Students, we're always there during U hour, you know, we're able to go in person. And we were always being like, oh, it's too small. This is a fire code hazard, you know.
Right.
Just to think, you know, it was even smaller to begin with. That's
right.
Think about that, especially with all the space. And like, you want to encourage students just go and be part of that community, and
yes,
you don't have enough space for them.
Right. And that's actually the current location is the third location. I don't know if you know that. So we started out in that small closet. And then by the time I took the full-time position, we were in building one up by the back doors. Oh. And by the vending machines there up on the second floor by the back doors, which was a really nice little suite of offices. We had my office, we had an office for the student assistants, little computers there people could use, and then a nice meeting room. And it was really nice little suite of offices. We teased about it because the first one we called the closet, but it was so, like, for people to walk in there, you know, the food court was right over there. Everything was very public. So people saw people coming in there, and the climate wasn't such that people would just sashay into the Pride Center necessarily, but people found their way. Then when we moved up to building one, it was a lot more sheltered kind of. And I think that was good at the time because it allowed people privacy. And some people jokingly told me they gained 5 pounds because they would come stand at the vending machines and, you know, end up buying candy when somebody came by or something because they were trying to go into the Pride Center. It's so different now, I think. Maybe not for some people, but they said they stood for months at those vending machines trying to get the courage to come into the Pride Center. You know, they gained 5 pounds inadvertently in the process. But it was a very welcoming place. And we really flourished there. And that's where we really started to be able to make a difference. Well, because you had a full-time coordinator for one thing. Mm-hmm. But we started to really get some visibility on campus there. Yeah. And then eventually we moved to your space, which was a great space. It doesn't have a lot of privacy per se. You have that big room, but it was a great space. I love the space, but it has its own challenges too. Yeah.
Yeah. We definitely are outgrowing that too. Cause I would say, I mean, you know, when we're in person, cause just a note for historical reasons, we're currently experiencing a pandemic that, you know, being in person, I still notice there are students, right? Especially the first few weeks who will walk by, come back, leave, come back, and really just, you know, need to have some extra support to come into the space. And so, yeah, I totally feel you on that and definitely getting outgrown. I know Roy mentioned that earlier.
It's a good problem.
I've heard from students that are like, oh yeah, I wanted to go in, but I didn't know any people, including myself. That was my first time as well. I just walked by, and I even bring new students from my own classes. When we have a lot of projects, we'd be like, oh, what are you doing right now? I was like, I'm going to go to the Pride Center. Like, what's that? Like, here's the resources. Here's your location. I'm like, oh, I've never been in here because a lot of people are like, oh, I didn't know we have this because it's all the way inside.
Right. Mm-hmm.
In the corner of the stables, yeah.
Yeah, and like all our students are just, mm-hmm. I need to take the first step. And that's always the hardest thing to do.
Yeah.
That's true.
Yeah, it's a cute space though. We were starting to leave the barn door open. So that there's this idea of it being a bigger room. Just having the glass door in like the multi-purpose room.
Right.
So you have this false sense of larger room.
Yes.
But no, it's a good spot. Thank you, Johnny. And I know you mentioned before, like about how maybe at the time it wasn't as welcoming, right? And so like, did you experience pushback from like faculty or staff at the time or people just not understanding the need for it?
Yeah. I mean, I think I do have kind of a gift or something about community organizing or reaching out and making bridges in communities. So I did that. Like before we even opened the Pride Center, we started the Safe Zone Project, the Safe Zone mm-hmm. Ally Training. And as the co-chair of the Gay and Lesbian faculty staff, one of the health educators went to a conference at Western Washington University, and she brought me a brochure, and she goes, this might be something we are interested in. So I looked at it, and I'm working in the police department. I was kind of the hate crime specialist in the police department, and sometimes the chief would let me go take reports, even though I wasn't a police officer, because, you know, I was maybe a little more delicate with people's feelings. And so I looked into it, I did some research, and I called Western Washington, and they said, you know, this is just a concept, we don't own it, you're welcome to use it, whatever. So I made contacts with people, allies, gay and lesbian faculty staff that I knew across campus, and I said, let's do this, you know, let's do this, we can do this. I had been involved in the cross-cultural retreat for years. I had done, I used to do some work on the side for the ADL World of Difference training. So I had done, you know, cross-cultural, multicultural type trainings. And so I said, we can, you know, figure out a set of exercises and different things and training that would be appropriate to get people to identify as allies. And so we did that. We created our own program. And this was huge at the time. It felt huge. We got to put that, you know how you do fall conference every fall. Yeah. You do this big breakout in a couple of days before the students come. There are workshops and things for faculty staff. We got to have a Safe Zone Ally workshop. and we presented it there. And there were a couple of faculty members from athletics, and they said we would be in so much trouble. We could be in so much trouble if our boss knew we were here in this workshop. And they worked with student athletes. You know, they worked with female athletes who, you know, were lesbians, and they said that the homophobia was so deep within the department and within different areas. You know, it's not just the department. I don't want to point my finger at them, but I once did a paper on homophobia in women's sports because I didn't understand it. I wasn't an athlete. I didn't get it. And it just baffled me. And they said that these older women professors in that department were taking this huge risk just to be there, but they were allies and they wanted to learn to get some skills and get some tools to be a better ally. That to me, it was like a champion day that we got this program up and running. And I know nowadays there's different thoughts on things, you know, it's so different now, 25 years later. But that was huge, you know, to get that up and running and get the approval. I actually took my proposal to the vice president of student affairs, and I wanted to be a lawyer when I was young, but that didn't happen. And I had my arguments. I had my, you know, I was going to just sell this. And he read my memo, and then we discussed for a minute, and he goes, okay, do it. And I was just shocked because I didn't get to argue or anything. You know, I just presented it, and he said, sounds good. So I had his stamp of approval, and we went with it. So I designed a little silly safes. I'm not a graphic artist. I designed something on the computer that we copied and, you know, printed and, you know, laminated and passed those around. So it was, that was a great day. Yeah. But that was actually before we started the Pride Center. So.
Especially at fall conference. I mean, we have like hundreds of people there. So that's a big deal. Cute.
Yes, it was.
That's awesome. Thank you for sharing that. Go ahead, Roy. Do you have some thoughts?
It's just a lot of information, but it's good information to know, especially when it comes to the Pride Center, something that students have used as someone, a place to call home, a place to meet friends, and it's good to know the history of it. It's really refreshing.
Thank you. Yes, I think so. I think it's so important to remember it. I tried to make archives when I was there, and it's, you know, you don't know if they will stay, because mostly at that point they were physical archives, you know. But the people live on. I still have contact with students that I worked with back then, and we see each other on Facebook. We check in every now and then, and it's really great, you know, to have that. We really were a support system for each other, and I mean the students, you know, they were so bonded. They helped each other. You know, we all went forward together. You know, and from going to very little visibility to in a few years, like a couple of years after the Pride Center was founded, we had ASI senators who were very, very out.
Wow.
And we had people just all over campus that were involved, not just in the Pride Center or in our things, but we, you know, they were now ASI senators and leaders in their like multicultural council and things like that. So that was great. We had we expanded our visibility a great deal, and we didn't have, you know, we didn't have a month or anything. We went from having, you know, we celebrated National Coming Out Day. And then we went from that to doing a week. And the reason we did October was because we built it around National Coming Out Day. Plus it was a month that nobody else was using. So it was a good month. Yeah. But I remember we had our forces gather, and we went before ASI, and we did a presentation, and we fought to get a History Month founded, you know, so that we could also have funding and bring speakers and really have an impact on campus. And so that was amazing, and that was great, and it worked. You know, I think it took a couple of times of going before them and doing that, but yeah, I think it's definitely has a long-term impact on students' lives and those people that work with them. So
that's how the ASI money came to be. That's good to know.
Yeah.
That's awesome. And I noticed, like, when you're talking about gala, it's funny because we have the gala sign still up there, the original one on the wall.
Right.
Yeah, right when you walk in on the right, it's right there. And it gets me thinking about like the evolution, right, of language and identities. And so I'm wondering if you could maybe talk about your thoughts on that. Cause I know like now, you know, there's bisexual, trans, queer, right? Asexual folks are now included within the community. And I think that's become more common on campus. So yeah, I just wanted to know like what your thoughts are on that, because I see Gala and I'm like, wow, what a difference, you know?
Well, and it's interesting because that plaque, I don't even know who ordered it. Put it up and I said, take that down. This is gay, lesbian, bisexual, you know? Mm. And at the time, you know, we have to add bisexual. Mm-hmm. And, you know, to my knowledge, we didn't have any trans folks on campus, to my knowledge. Mm-hmm. And so I was very much insistent upon being bi-inclusive. And I did a lot of programming. I don't know if you've ever heard of Lani Kahahumanu. She was a huge leader in the bi movement. Okay. And the March on Washington, the big gay March on Washington years ago, is like leader of the bi contingency. And so we brought her to campus and we did a lot of education on that. And I was married for 18 years to a man. So, I mean, for me to, you know, oh, I'm a lesbian. Well, yeah, I identify as a lesbian, but I did so many speakers panels and I'd say, hi, I'm Johnny Owens and I'm a rebel femme, lesbian, identified bisexual, you know, and they'd look at me and I get to explain all that. So my gender identity was rebel femme, you know, my sexuality was lesbian, identified bisexual, you know, so, and I get to explain all of that to these classes, which was a lot of fun actually. And pretty, I think, educational.
Yeah.
So we did that. And then, you know, eventually, you know, trans became something that we needed to educate about. And, you know, whether it was fortunate or unfortunate, we had a couple of students that I knew. And one student was someone who came and she was transitioning and she had actually reached out to people before she came to make sure it would be okay. And she was an older student, but she lived in the dorms. And when housing found out that she was trans, they actually tried to evict her. And so we worked with her and we did tons and tons and tons of programming. Mm-hmm. These names might be outdated now, but we had Kate Bornstein come as she wrote My Gender Notebook. We did so many programs on gender. And, you know, I would go in and we would, you know, tell people to think about their gender. And you know, now it's so much beyond where we were, but we were thinking about it and we were talking about it and we were trying to make it inclusive. And I brought a film to campus, which has some funny side stories, but... I don't know, you know, we had those old VHS tapes in the library. Hey,
I have some right here. Mom wants me to convert these.
There's some great ones there. But we had Lauren Cameron, who was a wonderful photographer, and he did this book where he transitioned. He was a bodybuilder. So he did this book about beautiful photography book about transitioning. And so we actually housing kind of, they knew that they had not handled things the best way. So they gave us a bunch of programming money and they, and so they, I brought Lauren Cameron. He was up from the Bay Area and we were able to do a gallery exhibit of his work, his photography. And then we showed a film and it was published by the University of California Press or University of California Films. Mm-hmm. And it was called You Don't Know Dick. And it was all female to male transgender folks. Mm-hmm. And I had the best dinner. I took out my speaker, Lauren, for dinner before the program that night. And a bunch of his friends came from around here. And I had the best time. That was one of my most fun dinners I ever had was, you know, with these folks. And we had a ball, but that was great programming. It really, you know, opened people's eyes and got them talking about things. And so we did a lot around trans issues. I had always been interested in it. I don't know why, but for some reason, when I was 16 years old, I picked up a book out of my brother's bookcase and I was at his house and it was the story of Christine Jorgensen. Hmm. And she was the first trans American that people knew of. And and I read that. I was 16. It looked interesting. So I picked it out of his bookcase. I read it and wow, that's fascinating. So in my women's studies classes and things, I did a lot of reading and researching and wrote a fair amount of papers on things like that. I was just, I don't know, interested about the fluidity how gender can switch or change or whatever. Mm-hmm. And I was a real rebel for a long time when people would give you forms and say gender. They, you know, if they mean sex, why don't they just say sex?
But I know.
They say gender.
That's still.
Yeah.
That's the one
right in Rebel Fam, you know. So every time I'd write in Rebel Fam, because that was my little gender moniker, you know. And but anyway, I'm a little older now. I'm a little quieter, I guess. But but it was important work, and I'm glad we did it. And, you know, we got pushback on that. You know, we got pushback on the bisexual stuff from the gay and lesbian students, actually, when we first started that. And some of the students in the Pride Center, you know, at first they didn't quite get the trans stuff, but then they did, and they absorbed it. And one thing that helped a lot was I would take them to conferences. I would take them to the big UC conference every year.
Yes, we go to UC a lot.
Yes, and they would embrace their little CSU foster child, you know, here. And they were wonderful to me. And I would take my students to those conferences every year, and they would learn so much. Mm-hmm. And I remember, and this is probably pretty commonplace anymore, but at the time, I had a very flamboyant gay man who loved his flamboyance, and he was wonderful. Wonderful Alan, that was what we called him, you know. And he went to a conference, and he kind of got this huge crush on this person who was ambiguous, you know, who was gender ambiguous. And he said, you know, oh man, they're just so fantastic. And I said, yeah, so what's the problem? You know? Uh-huh. And he was just baffled by it, because he says, but I'm gay and I don't know what that means. And I said, it means you met somebody who's really fascinating and interesting. And so they're gender ambiguous, who cares, you know? Uh-huh. But it was really, it was those conferences brought them, you know, out of the little Cal Poly, you know, Cal Poly was kind of small and not, you know, quite as, you know, maybe knowledgeable as some other places. And so that's not the right word, but exposed to things. And so that was really great for my students when they would go to things like that.
That's awesome. Those are always fun. We do those field trips. Well, we used to, I should say, outside of the pandemic, but hopefully some of those conferences will be virtual even in the spring.
Yes.
Since the beginning of the Pride Center up to, you know, this point, do you ever recall any memories they had, or, you know, one of your most favorite ones? You know, there's probably a lot of them, but one of the most, like, favorite one they have.
Right. There are so many, it's hard to say what's favorite, but seeing, like, our first Lavender grad was just amazing. I mean, it wasn't amazing, like, you know, huge and fantastic. And it was in the conference room at the top of the CLA building. And I think we had 7 or 8 grads. And we just had a nice ceremony. We were supposed to have drag queens, but they never showed up. They got lost or something. And, you know, Mrs. Suzuki, Dr. Suzuki, the previous president, his wife never missed a Lavender grad, and she would always wear a lavender suit. And when her mother was alive, she would bring her mother with her and she would wear a lavender suit. And she was so supportive of the students. I mean, she was there every year, and I would think, what is she thinking at some of this stuff? Because some of it was silly and some of it was, you know, that was part of the culture, you know? So the first year that, remember, you probably were a child. I don't know. So I think it was Jerry Falwell said that Teletubby, the purple Teletubby, which was a little stuffed.
I remember that. People thought that the Teletubby
that he was gay. And so he was bad. So I, all of my friends and all of my family, they were giving them out, I think, at Burger King or something. We were all going to Burger King and getting those Teletubbies with the kids' meals. And we gave each graduate, each Lavender grad, a purple Teletubby to celebrate their gayness. Yeah. And I mean, that's so silly and non-academic.
That's awesome.
But it was, you know, it was a statement. It was a little kickback, you know, and little pushback. And, you know, whether it was the first Lavender grad or, you know, we did the vagina monologues. The Pride Center started the vagina monologues. And one reason that I wanted to do that Well, I had personal interest in violence against women, but also I thought, what a great way to get people into the Pride Center. You know, because the first year we did it, we had women from sororities that had never graced the doors of the Pride Center. We had people from all the different clubs and organizations on campus. They were excited about it. So they were coming in. Well, you'll need to rehearse your part with Ramon, my assistant. And so, yeah, you can meet him at the Pride Center. And so they'd be running lines at the Pride Center with Ramon. And these were people who had never thought about walking into the Pride Center. But we wanted to, you know, it was a great way to get the Pride Center out there and get people talking about us. And so the Vagina Monologues, even though it wasn't directly a queer event, it was a wonderful way to get people engaged with us and have some visibility. And so we did that, and we did lots of programming. We had some really great programming. And so definitely the Lavender Grad and the Vagina Monologues and just the pushback from our, okay, this is a funny story, and I don't think it's offensive to anyone, but I remember the film I mentioned about the transgender man, You Don't Know Dick, I got a call back that from the PR people and said, you know, you can't put that on the TV. And I said, why? And he says, well, you know, and I said, well, no, I don't. This is a, you know, this film was made and it's being distributed by a university press. It's a legitimate academic film. And so that's the name of the film. And he said, well, can't you change it? And I said, no, I'm not the filmmaker. I cannot change it. And so, you know, it really killed him. And I, at the end of the conversation, I think I said, you know, in a couple months, we're going to be doing the Vagina Monologues. And that's going to have to go up on the marquee too. So I'm sure I was a little bit of a pain. But anyway, that was, you have to get people, you know, this is our life. This is what we're dealing with. These are the things we're dealing with, you know, so we're not going to hide them away, and we need to publicize our programs. Mm-hmm. But other than that, I mean, we had some grand programs. We had one thing I was always proud of is we did some of the first real cross-cultural programming. Mm-hmm. We did with Mecha every Chicano History Month and every Pride Gay and Lesbian History Month. We would bring a Chicano comic, a Chicano queer comp to campus. Huh. And so, or a Chicana. So, I mean, and now I know language has changed, but that in that time, that's what we were bringing. So we would work together to do that. The first group we ever co-programmed with on campus was Hillel. Group. Mm-hmm. We celebrated Kristallnacht, the night of the breaking of the windows. And so that was a program we did to remember that part of history. And we did this wonderful co-program with them. And so I was always wanting to, you know, do that cross-cultural programming and intercultural programming. And it was great. I remember at our first, I think it was a scholarship dinner we had, I got the Indian Student Association was really friendly and nice, and they were really friendly with the Pride Center in the Multicultural Council, and they had great dancing, so we had them perform for us. That's at awesome. our scholarship dinner. So we had the Indian Student Association dancers, and they did a great job, you know. So we were always looking to bridge, you know, communities, and I think it worked well.
That's great.
So too many happy memories to pick one, honestly, but so many. And just going, you know, getting our feet in gear and climbing up that hill to paint the CP. At the time, it was only CP, not CPP, and paint those letters rainbow. And I remember the first time we did it, we were sitting in a coffee shop off campus down in downtown Pomona that we had met. And I think I had suggested, well, we should paint the CP, you know, everybody else does. And we could paint it rainbow, you know, we're brainstorming. And somebody said, well, aren't you limited to two colors? And I said, no, like most clubs have two colors, but our colors are the rainbow. So they can't tell us. We can't paint it the rainbow, you know? And so that's how we started doing that.
That's great. And,
yeah, it was great.
The students sometimes like to go up there, but I'm like, oh, I'm getting too old for this.
Oh, I know.
It's a hike. Even carrying the buckets of paint up there.
Yes. Yeah, it's a hike.
I've heard stories about going up those letters, and I've personally gone up the letters myself, and yeah, I agree. It's a hike.
Yeah, I had broken my ankle and had a major surgery. So I've had 3 surgeries on my ankle now, and I was so committed to going up there. I'm like, okay, I'm getting up there. And, you know, and on the other side, there are some sad memories, because a couple of years in a row, we would normally do that like on a Saturday or Sunday. We came into school on Monday, and it had black paint poured all over it, and people defaced it. More than once, I think twice, maybe 3 times, but that was so disheartening. Or we'd put up our History Month flyers and they'd be defaced, you know. And so we did. We didn't have, you know, huge hate crimes, but we definitely had hate incidents, and there was things that would happen. And the biggest thing, though, I remember about those issues, like the first year I was so devastated, and I said, well, we're going to go repaint. You know, we're going to go repaint. And then somebody called my office and said, what are you going to do? I said, we're going to go repaint. And they go, okay, I'll buy the paint. You know, these were just allies across campus. They said, well, we'll buy the paint for you, so you don't have to buy the paint again. And then the next year, you know, people were bringing snacks by and coming by to see if everybody's okay. And, it, you know, people checking in with us to provide, you know, support. And those folks, that was huge, you know, that we had a base of people on campus who were such great supporters, you know? And so the haters, that was a small, maybe visible a little bit, because their paint, you know, going over it, that's pretty visible, but the supporters were much greater, you know, and they were much greater in number. So I don't know who did that. And they probably just thought it was funny. They probably didn't have a huge amount of, you know, emotion attached to it. Who knows, you know,
yeah, that's really unfortunate.
Yeah. Well, and okay, then one other thing we did, which was cool, because Cal Poly, the Greek system, you know, we would get some pushback from the Greeks, and we'd hear about Obi and the Greek community and this. So we brought, and now I can't remember his name, but I think his name was Sean. He was big Greek gay guy who would go around and speak and things. So he came, and we brought him to campus, and he worked with the Greeks, and we did a co-program together, and that was pretty amazing. So yeah, he was in a fraternity, and he had come out, and then he had started this whole group that he would do, going out and kind of educating the Greek community. So we worked with him and did that work. So that was really important. It wasn't my most fun program, but it was a great one. Yeah,
it's important still
for students now. You know, what kind of advice would you give to the newer generation, being Generation Z, you know, with everything's going on?
I've said a few times to my friends that, and it makes me kind of emotional even, I don't know if I'd have the courage to do some of the things I did back then now, because people seem so critical. You know, it's like if I say something, and it's, language is so important. It really is. But we are human, you know, so if I don't do something quite right, you know, people kind of on Twitter or whatever, they just attack you instead of maybe taking you aside and saying, you know, or I'm not saying like haters who are putting horrible things, but people who are trying to do the right thing, you know, maybe help a little bit or advise them. Like, it's their responsibility to educate themselves. I understand that 100%, but I've told my friends, I don't know if I would be, you know, in the climate that there is now with everybody just jumping immediately on, I don't know if I would have the courage to do what I did, you know, because I didn't know what I was doing. I had been a mom. I had been a minister in my pre-lesbian life. Mm-hmm. And I had some administrative experience on a college campus, but how was I prepared to be the coordinator of the Pride Center? I don't know, but certain people thought I was. So, you know, it's like, okay, I know how to program. I know how to do budgets. I know how to do this. And I know how to care about people, and I know how to nurture these students, you know, and I can learn other things, but I didn't really know what I was doing. I wasn't really prepared for it. Mm-hmm. And it was a whole new position. I mean, no, I don't know if anyone, there wasn't schooling for it at the time. You know, it was brand new. So,
yeah. And the first in the Cal State too.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, I mean, I went down to UC Irvine and did their safe zone training. Pat Walsh had me come down there and do safe zone training for them. So that was new, and mm-hmm. you try to do the best you can do, try to do the right thing. Mm-hmm. And now, I don't know, it seems that there's so much critique, you know, and mm-hmm. And it's good to have critique. It's good to have discussion, and it's good to look at things and dissect them. Absolutely. But sometimes maybe a little softer tone or something, I don't know. That would be something that I think about from where I'm at now, that if I was there now, I don't know if I'd have the courage, you know, because if I do it wrong, I'm going to get attacked. And I had a situation, not with the Pride Center, but when I left the Pride Center, I was director of community outreach, and I ran the downtown center in Pomona in the Arts Colony for Cal Poly. Oh. And there was a young man that I would work with on a lot of community stuff. And he had one way of doing things. And this is this, you know, he had his little speech, and this was the way you did it. And I said, you know what? I really respect you, and I respect the work you do, but I don't think there's just one way to do it. I know that, like, there were students who perhaps did not, you know, take their lives because of some of the work and support that we were able to guide them to or provide to them. And so whether we did that work 100% correctly, or whether we did it according to your method, mm-hmm. it was good work, you know? Yeah. And so recognizing the good work that people do, whether they do it the way we do it or not, I think that's something. It's like maybe put a little grace into things, you know? I think that's important. And right now, you know, the whole world is polarized, so it's hard. Yeah. But when we're with like-minded people, maybe we have a little softer tone when we're calling them on something. If it's big to call them on it, call them on it. But maybe put some things in context, put some historical context to it, mm-hmm. and things, and then have conversations. Don't just throw them away, because maybe they have some valuable work within them that needs to be done.
Yeah, we do talk to students about this idea of, like, calling in instead of calling out. You know, right. Of course, if you have the energy for it, and depending on your relationship with that person, and to build coalition with each other, I think especially during these times right now, it's so important. So yeah, I appreciate that. And I know that students right now being at home and quarantine, you know, may not be in the best home situation. And I think that, you know, the podcast and other ways that we're trying to reach out to students can hopefully allow an opportunity to be involved and not necessarily have to do something live.
Right.
So, yeah. So do you have any other thoughts or advice for youth or the youths? I jokingly say that because I feel like I'm old. You know, for students listening in, you know, especially I think during these times where it seems really challenging.
You know, the same for all of us. I mean, I'm getting older. I just turned 68 in June, which blows my mind. But, you know, whether you're 20, 18, 15, I mean, I think there's so many more examples out there now. And that's wonderful that youth may see themselves on stage. They may see things at the Grammys. They're like, wow, that's so cool. Yeah. I love it. You know, I don't know much popular music, but I love watching and say, oh man, look at that representation. That's great. But, you know, just know that you are who you are, and you need to love yourself. And most students, I found this true. Most students were concerned their parents would reject them. And that certainly happened. But for the most part, a lot of parents already kind of suspected, and they just want their kids to be happy. And of course, that's not always, but that was, I would say, more often than not with the students I work with. And I think most parents, I'm a parent, I want my kids to be happy, you know? And so if we can support each other, youth, if you can support each other and just do the best you can do, but just know that you have to accept yourself before anybody else can accept you. We had a saying at the Pride Center. It was something like, we're not here to out you, but like, you need to come out to yourself so you can be comfortable coming out to others, you know? And that's true. You have to be comfortable with your own sexuality and your own identity, whatever that might be, before you can expect anyone else really to be comfortable with it. So get comfortable in your own skin. And that's a big work, you know? Yeah. That's a big load of work sometimes, but it's important work, and it's, you know, it will help you do well, you know, it will help you prosper in so many ways. And so I think that's all I could say. I have no wealth of wisdom. I just have some years of experience. And take good care of yourself. That's what I try to do every day. You know, I try to make sure I take care of myself. I do the things I love to do. you know, I drove down to the Wild Animal Safari Park Monday to see some lions.
Oh, cool.
And tigers. And just, you know, it was very well distanced and all that. And I just thought, no, it's a long drive, but who cares? I need to see some tigers and get happy, you know. Or if it's go out in nature or go garden, whatever I need to do. I'm like, I need to do this to take care of myself. So I'm going to do it. And nobody else is going to do it, really. We have to take care of ourselves, number one. So that's important.
Mm-hmm. But thanks so much,
I really appreciate you inviting me and that you're keeping the history alive.
Yep, we're trying, and I'm glad we have, you know, the internet and digital archives now to be able to do that. So we really appreciate you joining us, and thank you for folks listening in, and we hope you enjoy this episode, and thank you again, Johnny, and thanks
Thank you. Nice to meet you, Roy.